I'm going to give you, it's kind of a short sutta tonight because I'm going to be talking about what you do when you get off retreat. This is called the Simile of the Saw, and it's a rather important sutta. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathan Pandika's Park. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Moliya Paguna was associating overmuch with bhikkhunis. He was associating so much with bhikkhunis that if any monk spoke dispraise of those bhikkhunis in his presence, he would become angry and displeased and would make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu spoke dispraise of the Venerable Moliya Paguna in those bhikkhunis' presence, they would become angry and displeased and would make a case of it. So much was the Venerable Moliya Paguna associated with the bhikkhunis. Then a certain monk went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what was taking place. Then the Blessed One addressed a certain monk, thus, "Come, monk, tell the monk Moliya Paguna in my name that the teacher calls him." "Yes, Venerable Sir," he replied, and he went to the Venerable Moliya Paguna and told him, "The teacher calls you, friend Paguna." "Yes, friend," he replied. He went to the Blessed One after paying homage to him and sat down at one side. The Blessed One asked him, "Paguna, is it true that you're associating overmuch with the bhikkhunis? That you're associating so much with the bhikkhunis that if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it. And if any monk speak dispraise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they would become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Are you associating so much with the bhikkhunis as it seems?" "Yes, Venerable Sir," Paguna replied. "Paguna, are you not a clansman who's gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." "Paguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desire and any thought based on the household life." In other words, getting mad and making a case of what he's doing. "And herein you should train thus: my mind will be unaffected and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate." That is how you should train, Paguna. Now, this is a real important little statement. It doesn't matter what somebody else says. Don't make a case of it. Let's say you go to work and your boss is angry about something you might or might not have done. And the first thing you see in the morning is this boss throwing his anger at you. What do you normally do? Take his anger make it your anger, and throw it back. And then you both start speaking at the same time. So you don't know what he's saying, he doesn't know what you're saying. Then he goes away, stomps off. What do you do in your mind? What happens in your mind? You start playing that whole scene again. I don't like this. And you start repeating all the things you said to him. And you start wishing that you had said something other than that. I should have said this to him because he threw his anger at me. Then I'm right and he's wrong. And what do you do when you see the next person that comes around? You start complaining about the boss because he was angry and making up gossip, which is making up stories to justify that anger. And you'll carry that anger with you through the whole day. And it'll come up again, just like it was on a tape deck. What he said, what I should have said, I'm right, they're wrong. And you get very tired. And you go home and you say, leave me alone, I've had a bad day. And you go to sleep at night and you don't sleep very well. You toss and turn. And you get up the next morning and you're groggy. Now just from one situation of taking someone else's anger and make it your own, you've suffered a whole day and a night. And you might say some more of those kind of things, that gossip, how you don't like the way he's treating you, and saying things that aren't necessarily true. But when you practice loving kindness, somebody comes up with you and they're angry at you, you start having compassion for that person because you know what it feels like to be angry. And you know how painful it is to be angry. And you see that in him. So instead of taking his anger and making it your own, excuse me, you start radiating loving kindness to him. And as you're radiating loving kindness to him, you don't necessarily smile at him because he's going to be not understanding that, but you're smiling in your heart because you're not paying attention to his anger or what he's saying. Before long, what will happen is he'll start to settle down, and then you can discuss what the real problem is because it's not what he was talking about. And you can solve the problem, whatever that happens to be. Then, when you're done, your mind is clear. You're not repeating that whole situation anymore because you've been radiating loving kindness. You've changed the situation so that it's understandable, and if there is a problem, it can be fixed very easily. So the next person you see, what do you say to them? Your mind is bright, your mind is clear, your mind is in the present moment. You're not going to get into that complaining state. Sometimes at the center there's some women that don't get along. And when they start fighting with each other, the first thing they do is come and knock on my door. And they're really angry and they're talking at the same time. And I say, okay, I see what's happening. I'm not stupid enough to get in the middle of that. Because I don't know what the real problem is. So I start radiating loving kindness to them. And just in a couple of minutes, they stop yelling and talking at the same time. And then they start discussing things, and they find out that there isn't really that much of a problem. And they support each other, and then they start laughing with each other. And then they say, you know, I'm real busy right now. I gotta go. I'll see you later. Thank you, Bhante. And I haven't said a word. But I gave them what they really wanted. They wanted to be loved. And then they turned into real human beings instead of angry human beings. So this is what this is talking about. If somebody says something that you don't like or you don't agree with, fine, that's their opinion. You don't have to take it as the truth. You don't have to take it as yours personally. What you need to do is see that that person is suffering. Have compassion for them. Don't try to talk them out of their suffering. Just start radiating loving kindness to them. And see what happens. It's almost like it's magic. Because you take two people that are fighting and saying things that are hurtful to each other, and then they stop doing that and they start discussing what the problem might be, and they find out it's not such a big deal anyway. And then that mental upset is over because when they came in, I started radiating loving kindness. And they know that's what's going to happen when they come into my and start talking in my kuti. So try to make it a habit with your daily activities to whoever is coming up and talking to you. It doesn't matter whether they're happy or unhappy. Radiate some loving kindness to them. It makes the whole place feel better. Now that's how you affect the world around you. So your workplace becomes much more efficient because there isn't all of this wasted time of being over-aggressive and fighting and all of this nonsense kind of behavior. And it is nonsense. Doesn't make any sense at all. Well, that's the way I'm supposed to be. No, it's not. So you radiate loving kindness to all people that you talk to, just for a moment. And then you can discuss whatever it is that needs to be talked about. But it's done with a mind that's uplifted. It's done with a mind that's very light and alert. So the more you can remember to practice that as your daily activity, the more you affect the world around you in a positive way. And then life starts to be fun, like it's supposed to be. right? You start changing the way you see the world because you keep practicing loving kindness. Now, when I first came back to this country, I'd been in Asia for 12 years and decided I wanted to come back to this country and start teaching Dhamma here. I was about 100 miles out from the United States, and I started feeling extreme anger, fear, greed, anxiety. I wanted to go up and tell the pilot, I want to go back. And if you want to affect the world around you and change other people's minds, you don't do it by trying to convince them of anything. You do it by being the example and radiating loving kindness and wishing everybody well. One of my favorite things in to do when we go to the store is I kind of wander around looking for children that are unhappy. I want this. So I go up and stand beside them and start radiating loving kindness. And then they have this shocked look in their eyes and they look up at me and they start smiling. Great fun. And the mother really appreciates it. And more often than not, I'll say something to the mother about how well-behaved their children are. They're good kids. All they wanted was to be loved. They wanted somebody to pay attention to them. So I did, with love. And walk away, and mom is smiling, and the kids are smiling, and quiet, and accepting of what's happening in the present moment. Now, sometimes people watch me do this, and they'll walk away smiling. Oh, that was really amazing. Well, it takes practice. But what else do you have any better to do with your mind? Right? Now, a lot of people have this idea that meditation is only while you're sitting. Well, no. Meditation is living. Meditation is having your mind alert and mindful all the time. I've gone to a lot of retreats. Always at the end, the teacher would say, okay, now the retreat is over, go out and be mindful. But they don't give you any idea of how you're supposed to do that. Sometimes they'll say, well, be mindful of your body. What does that mean? Be mindful of your body, okay. I'm going to pick up this loaf of bread. Is that it? No. It's acting in a way that you have an uplifted mind as much as you can remember. So that's why I picked that name for my book. Life is meditation, meditation is life. So you really get the idea that it's not only about sitting, it's about living. Do you have hindrances arise in your daily life? Okay. By doing this kind of retreat while you're here and keeping your mindfulness going and your smile going while you're here, what I'm trying to show you is you can do this all the time. It takes practice to remember. You're going to have hindrances arise. But now you're going to be able to recognize them. A lot of the other meditation retreats, and there's even some small books put out by the Buddhist Publication Society on how to suppress hindrances. And there were very famous monks that were writing like that. But seeing a hindrance as a friend to help you remind yourself to use the six R's and relax and come back to smiling with your daily activities, then you start affecting the world around you in a positive way. So the anxiety, the sadness, the anger, the greed is gonna become less the more you practice it around you. It's real important to carry this with you. Why do I tell you I want you to radiate loving kindness when you're eating, when you're walking, when you take a shower? Because that helps train you to see the hindrances while you're doing these activities, and you can 6R those. And the more you can do that, the easier your meditation becomes when you sit. And sitting is important. You don't have to sit as much as you do in retreat. What I generally tell people is when they get off retreat, it's a good idea to sit no less than an hour a day. An hour isn't very much. But what most people do is they say, okay, I'm going to sit every evening at this time. But somebody comes along and let's go out to dinner. And then you say, well, I'll meditate tomorrow. And tomorrow something else happens. Well, I'll meditate tomorrow. And then you get out of the habit and you just forget about it. But when you practice this every day and you radiate loving kindness and you use the six R's when a hindrance arises, and they will, I promise. Now you know what to do with it. You use the six R's, you get into smiling, help and give your smile away as much as you can remember. So this practice that I'm trying to show you just in this short 10 days, you see the change that happens for you. Take that outside. Take that into your life. You're still going to get caught by some anger, and you're going to start seeing a little bit more quickly, what am I doing to myself getting caught up in this? Is it that important? No, it really isn't. It's just because I want things to be the way I want them to be. So when you 6R, you start losing the personal attachments. And you start developing a mind that has more balance in it, more equanimity in it. You're still going to have some ups and downs. Okay. But they're not going to be so radical. It's not going to happen for days on end. being angry at someone or being sad or caught up in your depression. So I'm hoping that you can keep your practice going every day. And I highly recommend that you sit in the morning. I had one student, he had kids in Malaysia. The young kids had to be at school in the afternoon, but the older kids, they were at school in the morning, starting at 6 o'clock. So they all had to get up very early. And what he did was got up an extra 2 hours early because it was quiet. And he would sit for 2 hours before he got his kids up. And he did it every day. He went to bed early because he had to, in order to keep that kind of schedule. I'm not recommending that you get up 2 hours early and then go to work. But get up so that you can sit for an hour before you go to work. Don't just get out of bed and start sitting. Get out of bed, do your morning things. Put your clothes on, brush your teeth, eat, and now you're awake. Now sit for an hour. And in the evening, if you have time and inclination, then sit again. That's your bonus time. Keeping your precepts without breaking them will make your meditation better. One of the things that the Buddha said over and over again, if you keep your precepts, your mind will naturally become peaceful. So you don't have to spend so much time with hindrances whenever they arise. And you will have a small dip in your practice. Your practice isn't going to be as good as it is here because you're not spending as much time and you're running around doing this and that, whatever needs to be done. So, for most of the people here, what I'm suggesting is you go back to the loving kindness, but in the six directions. And when you do that, and you do it every day, you will start to progress again. And you'll get into the compassion, and then the joy, and then the equanimity. It'll take a while to do that, but that's okay. The more you can practice during the day, the easier your sitting is going to become. That's a fact. You can attain Nibbana at any time. Doesn't have to be in a retreat. I had one lady that she did pretty well on the retreat. She went home. She started doing her mindfulness and just practicing loving kindness while she was cleaning the house and taking care of the kids and doing all of that. She says she started doing the dishes. And all of a sudden she felt her mind just go, and she thought, I'm going to go sit down for a little while. And she attained Nibbana then. It can happen at any time. So, what do you need to do is remember to keep your practice going as much as you can. And you cannot criticize yourself because you forget. This is a game. Keep it light. You forgot for a couple hours. Okay, start again. don't come down on yourself. Oh, I didn't keep my metta going very well. Okay, so you forgot. It's all right that you forget. But try to remember. And when you remember, with a light mind, not a critical mind, keep things going as much as you can remember. At one time in Malaysia, I had some of my students write down how long they could stay with the loving kindness during the day. I mean, if it's 10 seconds, they would write down 10 seconds. If it was 5 minutes because they had to wait for somebody, then it was 5 minutes, whatever it was. And this lady came to me and she said, you know, I could only stay with loving kindness for 12 minutes today. And I said, that's great. Oh, you mean it comes up naturally as you practice it, and you're not going to be able to do it all the time. So you don't criticize yourself when you forget. You just do it again. This is a play it again, Sam. Practice. One of the things that happened with people, that they'd go back to work and they'd keep their practice going, and the people at work would go, you're a lot different. You don't get angry like you did before. You don't use harsh words. What are you doing? I want some of that. That's how you affect the world around you. It's remembering to practice. And have fun while you're doing it. And laugh with people. Now, all of you hear Doug and David and I giggling and laughing all the time. Why? Because it makes me feel good. I'm happy. I'm especially happy because I can help you. And you'll be able to help other people by being the example. Just smiling and laughing with people, it's great fun. And again, you're going to forget and you'll get emotional and you'll get upset, but you'll start noticing more quickly. And you see that you're causing yourself suffering. So, stop doing that. But I'm going to this so-and-so, I hate that. Isn't that funny? I had somebody that was practicing meditation and their daily activities, and they got angry. And she came to me and said, what am I supposed to do? I have all of these repeat thoughts, they're anger thoughts. I said, well, you got to laugh at them. I can't laugh at something like this. This is a serious problem. And when she said that, that was one of the funniest things I'd ever heard. And I started laughing. And then she started laughing because she saw, oh, it is dumb, isn't it? I'm really hurting myself. And then I said, remember that. It's not such a big problem. Every time we start getting serious, the problem starts to turn into Mount Everest. There's no way over it. There's no way around it. There's no way under it. It's just this huge problem. And I have to solve it. And I don't know what to do. Laugh at how crazy your mind is. And when you do, what happens? That huge problem is a little tiny bump in the road. No big deal. But your mind builds it up into a big deal if you don't use the six R's and have a light mind. It's magical. And it's true magic of seeing somebody's mind change from being angry to being happy. That's real magic. And it, like I keep saying, it's fun. Well, I've got these money problems. I have no idea where I'm going to get the money to do this or that, and I'm going to have all of these problems. And well, you can think about that if you want. You certainly aren't going to come up with a way to make it any better with that kind of a mind. So smile and laugh with it. The more you do that, then all of a sudden your intuition starts to kick in, and now, oh, that's not such a big deal. Let's try this. And you find out it works. Okay, great. When you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma takes care of you. You take care of it for yourself, and you give your smiles and happy feelings away, and more magical things start to happen. But when you start getting serious, oh boy, there's the problem. So this particular sutta is very important because it's showing you how to practice with your daily activities. Radiate loving kindness to everybody you see. And use them as the reminder to start radiating loving kindness to everybody around you. When you're radiating loving kindness to strangers, don't look them in the eye, because that is not understood very well. And that can cause problems. So just look around and radiate loving kindness. Keep making that determination in the morning that when you wake up in the morning, you're going to be smiling and happy. That's really nice in the household. Your kids, they see you smiling, then they're not going to be so grumpy about going to school. Or your mate is not going to be grumpy. They see somebody else, you see somebody else smile, and that reminds you, oh, okay, I want to do that too. Now you do this with your daily activities. Get in the habit of your home. You have to drive to work. When you're walking to the car, what are you doing with your mind? Oh, thinking about this and thinking about that and worrying about this and that. So what you need to do, let that go and practice your walking meditation, radiating to all beings. You get in the car and you get in a traffic jam. What are other people doing with their mind? How much do they like the traffic jam? Not really very much. So you have compassion for them. And you start radiating loving kindness to them. You don't need a distraction of listening to a radio. You can just radiate loving kindness whenever you have to stop the car. That's okay. it's kind of surprising how much the traffic improves when you do that. And it is true. It seems like the traffic jam just unjams itself more quickly. So, practice that every day as much as you can remember. When you come back for retreat next year, your progress in the meditation is going to be very good, because you're starting to make it a habit. We need more arahats in the world. And how do you get to do that? By practicing. Ah, but I don't want to become an arahat. Okay, don't. During the time of the Buddha, only about between 10 and 15% of the monks actually practiced meditation. Most of the monks were more into memorizing the suttas and then giving Dhamma talks through their memorizing the suttas. In the Third Buddhist Council, which was about 250 years after the Buddha died, the monks sat down in the council and they decided what is the best way to keep the teachings alive. And they decided it was through memorizing the suttas. So when you hear the suttas and if you feel like meditating, then you'll know how to do it. This country, most people don't think a whole lot of monks. You can attain Nibbana without being around monks. But the monks are the people that keep things alive. And they're very necessary. And the more you can support the Sangha, the easier it is for the monks to give the Dhamma. They don't have to keep traveling around from one place to another because they can't find a suitable place to live. And to be quite honest, there's a lot of Westerners that go to Asia and they take the robes on and then they feel like coming back and they can't find a place. Because every place they would say, okay, I'm going to go to this temple or that temple, it's a cultural center and they're not interested in having foreign monks there unless the foreign monks happen to speak their language. And so a lot of people disrobe. Well, that hurts us a lot. That hurts the Dhamma a lot. So one of my goals is to start setting up other American monasteries. They don't have to do anything with me. But I want to be able to set places up so that when American monks come back to America, they'll have a place where they can continue on with the practice. Now, a lot of times in Asia, people will ordain for 2 or 3 or 4 years and they come back and they're real enthusiastic until they can't find a suitable place to stay and then they disrobe. So if we start setting up places for them to actually go and have an American be the abbot, then Buddhism will flourish. But as it is right now, there's my place. There's a place in West Virginia that Venerable Gunaratana set up. A lot of Western monks go there. And Abhayagiri, the place in California at Valley Center, it's still a cultural center, even though the abbot is an American. The Thai that go there are not real happy to see Americans there so much. And as a result, not a lot of monks will stay there for any length of time. So there's very few places that are available for monks. When if we can start building places that are not Asian, that are American, then the Dhamma will start flourishing a lot more. I know a lot of people that go to different places and they become very disillusioned with Buddhism, because if you don't speak Thai or Burmese or you don't speak Vietnamese, then why, you know, if you don't speak that language, you're not going to be accepted very well. And that's a problem. So, eventually, hopefully, we can start setting up more places and having monks that have been in Asia, like I was, for 12 years. After being a monk for 10 years, you can be an abbot of a monastery, because you're supposed to be well-educated enough to do that. So if we have places that are available that they can come and actually keep the tradition going, then Buddhism in America is just going to take off. It'll take off at its own speed. When I first came back to America, my first retreat was for two people. But that was okay. Over a period of time, with a good foundation, then more and more people start coming for the retreats and benefiting, and then going out and helping other people. Not by proselytizing, not by being a born again, but by being example. We need to have scholar monks. And we need to have practicing monks. In the Anguttara Nikaya, there's one sutta that talks about how scholar monks and practicing monks quite often criticize each other. And the Buddha said that we have to have both. We have to have both kinds of monks in order to have good balance. The scholar monks are going to teach people that want more scholarship. And the practicing monks are going to teach people that practice. I'm kind of an unusual monk because I really do know a lot about the suttas. And I have a practice. But we're getting it set up so that it's this year, 3 monks have said that they were going to come for the Rains Retreat, which is from June to October. And we're going to be working on translations. One of the monks that wants to come, he was a major influence in my life and how I came to just study the suttas without the commentaries. He's 86 years old. Brilliant. The way he gives Dhamma. And he wants to come in the worst way. He really does. He said, I really want to come. I said, good. I have a cootie for you. You'll be well taken care of. Not a problem. But we're going to be working and doing translation. And what we need is three or four monks that are really Pali scholars so we can get into discussions about what is the best English word that we can use that gives close enough to the same meaning of what the original texts are. So it's going to be practicing monks and scholar monks together to put, I'm going to make this a sub-commentary of the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's going to have the language of meditation, not just scholarship. It's going to take a while to do this, and it's going to be a lot of hard work, but I really think it's necessary. And as we have more and more monks that are scholars, and they come and practice meditation, then their understanding is going to grow. And when they go back to their country, they're going to be teaching people in the correct way. Now, a lot of different practices occur in a lot of different countries. But we want to get people to see that there are not different meditations. There's only one meditation. There's a lot of different objects of meditation, but there's only one meditation. And that is being able to see and recognize craving when it arises and how to let that go. Whether they use what we call the six R's or not, I don't care. I'm not particularly attached to six R's. As a matter of fact, I didn't even make it up. One of my students made it up on retreat. He was really understanding the meditation very well, and one day he came up with a little tiny piece of paper like that, and he handed it to me and he said, this is what you're teaching. And it turned out to be the six R's. So we started using it because it seems like you can understand it more easily than just saying, there is four kinds of right effort and going through that. It seems like it's a little easier to understand when we practice right effort, but we use a little bit different words. And it seems to be growing because there's a lot of people that are taking the brochures for six R's and putting it in their own language. Seems to be growing pretty well. And that's great. I wish I could remember the name of the student to give him the credit for coming up with it. But this was 15 years ago. So, there's a little story in this sutta that that I wanted to read for you. It's in section number 9, if you're looking. Formerly, monks in the same Sawati, there was a housewife named Vedika, and a good report about Mistress Vedika had spread thus. Mistress Vedika is gentle. She's meek. She's peaceful. Now, Mistress Vedika had a maid named Kali, who was very clever, nimble, and neat in her work. The maid Kali thought, "A good report of my lady has been spread thus. Mistress Vedika is gentle, meek, and peaceful." Now, how is it now? Well, she does not show anger. Is it nevertheless actually present in her, or is it absent? Or else, is it just that my work is neat and my lady shows no anger, though she actually has it present in her? Suppose I test my lady. So the maid Kali got up late. Mistress Vedika said, "Hey, Kali, what is it, madam? What is the matter that you get up so late?" "Nothing is the matter, madam." "Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up so late." And she was angry and displeased and scowled. Then the maid Kali thought, "The fact is that while my lady does not show anger, it's actually present in her, not absent. And it's just because my work is neat that my lady shows no anger, though it's actually present in her. Suppose I test my lady a little more." So the maid Kali got up later in the day. Then Mistress Vedika said, "Hey, Kali, what is it, madam? What's the matter that you get up even later in the day?" "Nothing is the matter, madam." "Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up later in the day." And she was angry and displeased and spoke words of displeasure. Then the maid Kali thought, "The fact is, while my lady does not show anger, it's actually present in her, not absent. And it's just because my work is neat that my lady shows no anger, though it's actually present in her, not absent. Suppose I test my lady a little bit more." So Kali got up later in the day. Then Mistress Vedika said, "Hey, Kali, what is the matter? What is it, madam? What is the matter that you get up still later in the day?" "Nothing is the matter, madam." "Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl. You get up still later in the day." And she was angry and displeased. And she took a rolling pin and gave her a blow on the head and cut her head. Then the maid Kali, with blood running down her head, denounced the mistress to the neighbors. "See, lady, the gentle lady's work. See, ladies, the meek lady's work. See, ladies, the peaceful lady's work. How can she become angry and displeased with her only maid for getting up late? How can she take a rolling pin and give her a blow on the head and cut her head?" Then later on, a bad report of Mistress Vedika spread thus. "Mistress Vedika is rough. She's violent. She's merciless." So too, monks. Some monk is extremely gentle, extremely meek, extremely peaceful, so long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch him. But it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch him that it can be understood whether that monk is really kind, gentle, and peaceful. I am not calling a monk easy to admonish, who is easy to admonish and makes himself easy to admonish only for the sake of getting robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. Why is that? Because that monk is not easy to admonish. He gets angry. Things don't go the way he's supposed to go. And he's not easy to admonish, nor make himself easy to admonish when he gets no robes, alms food, resting place, or medicinal requisites. But when a monk is easy to admonish and makes himself easy to admonish, because he honors, respects, and reveres the Dhamma, him I call easy to admonish. Therefore, monks, you should train thus. We shall be easy to admonish and ourselves make ourselves easy to admonish because we honor, respect, and revere the Dhamma. That is how you should train, monks. Now, I say monks, but I should say students. Monks, there are these five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. When others address you, their speech may be timely or untimely. When others address you, their speech may be true or untrue. When others address you, their speech may be gentle or harsh. When others address you, their speech may be connected with good or with harm. When others address you, their speech may be spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. Herein you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train. So, this is great advice, and it does take practice, because people are going to say all kinds of things, gentle or harsh, and it might be all untrue. So that's their opinion. They can think the way they want to think, but you see them as a person that's suffering, and you radiate loving kindness to them and use them as a reminder to keep it going with your daily activities. That is how you should train. So this gives you more of an idea of what to do with your daily activities. Too many people think that meditation is only about sitting, and it is about living. You've heard me say that over and over. Because it's true. Okay, then we're going to 20. Monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handed saw, he who gives rise to a mind of hatred towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. That's pretty radical, isn't it? Herein, monks, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train. If you keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind, do you see any course of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? No, venerable sir. Therefore, monks, you should keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind. That will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. That's what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that's really pretty amazing advice. I've had people write to me and email me and say, it's too bad that the Buddha didn't tell us in more suttas how to actually practice. And I wrote back and I said, you don't know how to read the suttas, apparently, because the suttas all have the Four Noble Truths in them, or at least three of the Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha is telling you how to live your life and your daily activities. Go to the sutta and tell me that that's not true. The simile of the saw. It's pretty amazing. So what other people say, they can say it. Doesn't matter. You radiate loving kindness to them. Well, what they told me was a lie. So? That's their problem, not yours. Don't make it your problem. Radiate loving kindness to that person because they tell you a lie, you know they're suffering. So the more you can remember to radiate loving kindness, no matter what somebody else says, when they say it or how they say it, you use them as a reminder to radiate loving kindness to them, and then start radiating loving kindness to all beings. If enough people can do that, we will change the ideas of the entire country and world. But you have to practice it. Practice it with your daily activities. You don't have to get mad at somebody for saying what their opinion is. That's their opinion. It could be true or untrue. It doesn't matter. What matters is what you're doing inside you. And you radiate that loving kindness just because it feels good. It's fun. It's neat to watch other people light up and become happy. It's magical. And you benefit greatly. So the more you can practice this, the easier everything becomes. So when you go home, don't expect for this meditation to be as deep as it is now, unless you're going to practice 3 or 4 hours a day. If you practice 3 or 4 hours a day, you have the time and you can do it. That's just great. And your mind is going to get more and more of a sense of balance in it. You're going to have disenchantment starting to arise, making a big deal out of things. And even food, you're going to get started disenchanted with, I have to have this food because I really want it. And get excited. But what happens in Asia, now food is like the most important thing in their life. It really is. And they always make a big deal out of, I'm going to go to this restaurant because it's the best one for this. And then they start getting disenchantment and they look at that food and, well, I have to eat. This is here, so I'm going to eat it, whatever it happens to be. When I went to Asia, I started out on the wrong foot because I really didn't care for rice. And I got really, really tired of it. And it's like, I was going out for alms food every day. And I was walking and I was getting all kinds of food, but huge amounts of rice. And they call eating, it's time to eat rice. That's what they call for their meals. And finally, because I'm a slow learner, it took about 6 years. Finally, I said, you know, if I'm going to stay here, I might as well stop hating this stuff. I caused myself all kinds of problems because I just got tired of eating the same thing over and over and over again every meal. It's rice in the morning, rice at lunch, you know, it's... And after that, it didn't bother me. Well, there's rice. Okay, fine. I'll tell you a secret. If you go to Sri Lanka, get their fried rice. It's amazing. The fried rice, they don't export it. They only eat it in that country. So you can't go out and get some and say, we'll see what it's like. You can only get it in Sri Lanka. And it'll change your mind on rice. I'll tell you. But I caused myself 6 years of suffering because of that. Over and over, every day, rice, rice, rice. Oh, sometimes we change it a little bit and we make it sticky rice. Okay. But it's still rice. So, after that, I started enjoying the food much more. One of the reasons to go to Asia is for the fruit. They have a lot of different kinds of fruit that you never see here. And I got to tell you, it's really worth it. You'll become a fruitarian when you go there because there's so many different kinds of fruit that you've never seen before that are just absolutely brilliant. You're starting to see sometimes here, they put it in cans. Don't do that. Don't even try it. You don't have an idea what the real thing is like. So your mind starts to get more and more balance in it as you have more equanimity and you start to have And some people here, when they got to a certain place in their meditation, their voice had such equanimity and balance in it. It was amazing to listen to them speak. Voice is very quiet, very balanced. And you know that their mind is the same way. Accepting of whatever it is, okay. How's your meditation going today? Fine. Everything is good. Anything new and exciting? No, not really. Everything is fine. Your mind, their voice is like that. It's really kind of fun. So you can progress at home. You can attain nibbana at home, but you have to keep your practice going. If you have any problems, you go through something you don't know, well, there's some people that you can get in touch with by email, or you can join our Yahoo group. And if you join the Yahoo group, there's more people that you'll get three or four different answers. Mm-hmm. And they'll all pretty much agree because everybody's practicing. And you can find out what to do. If that doesn't work for you, then get in touch with David. Anybody that comes up with a question, David comes with the paper to me and say, what do you want to say about this? So you're really getting the answer from me, but it's going through David. So if you can keep your practice going and not beat yourself up when you forget, or sometimes one day you'll get in a hurry and I got to go do this. Try to make up in the day that hour so that you can keep your practice going. If you can be consistent with that, your next retreat is going to be phenomenal. Not just regular good. We need more anagamis in this world. We need more arahats in this world. And this is a way to get them. Okay? Do you have any other questions about what to do with your daily activities? That's, yeah. And there's still times that there can be anger or dissatisfaction or irritability arise, but now what's going to happen is you're going to recognize it more quickly and not be caught in it. You're not going to be caught for a whole day with something like this. You might be caught for a short period of time, and then you start going, why am I doing this to myself? And then try to remember to 6R and laugh with yourself for getting caught, and then you're not caught anymore. But what you're doing by doing the 6Rs and going deep is you're uncovering different things that you've had pushed down for a long time. And that's one of the things that can happen with one-pointed concentration, is that you'll get to a certain point and then you get into what's called access concentration, and the force of the concentration pushes the hindrance down. But the hindrance can be down for a long time. And then when you start practicing this, then it starts uncovering that, and it's just an old habitual tendency that got pushed down, and now it's starting to come up. And that way you can use your 6 R's, and it will fade away and it won't happen again. But this is the way you change seeing the world around you, by letting go of the hindrances when they arise, not taking things so personally, and forgiving yourself when you forget. It will get much easier and faster. Forgiveness is a great meditation. When somebody says something and you see your mind grab onto it and you start to get that anger and irritation coming up, forgive that person, forgive yourself right then. It won't manifest as coming out in a harsh way. So, forgiveness, we only had a limited number of books on forgiveness. But we just ordered some more that are coming to Dhammasuka?
Yeah.
Okay. And let us know and we'll send you a copy. This is probably the best book on forgiveness. It's a booklet. It's not very long. That I've ever seen. And it sounds kind of weird that I say something like that, because it was taken from a talk that I gave on forgiveness, so it sounds like I'm building myself up. But no, it is. It explains how to do forgiveness meditation, not only when you're sitting, but all the time. And it starts to change your perspective of the world. And you start letting go. The forgiveness meditation is probably the most powerful meditation that I've ever seen, because it can change your old habitual habit of always acting this way and change that into acceptance and not having so much emotional upset arising. Now, I don't remember what retreat I gave this talk on, but and I might have done it here. I have a wood-burning stove. And when it starts getting cold, I have a hot room. I keep it around 80, so it takes a lot of wood to do that. And sometimes I put it in and something happens and I hit some of the metal and it burns. Okay? As soon as that happens, and this is part of, I experiment with forgiveness, just making sure that it works the way I think it does. When I start forgiving that, by the next day there's no blister, there might be a little red spot, in 2 days it's gone. But when I don't, and I don't on purpose, then there's a blister, it lasts for about 2 weeks. And it's painful for that period of time. So just this little forgiving this pain for being there, forgiving myself for doing that, helps to heal your body. So whenever you do some kind of owie or have some kind of pain arise in your body, the first thing your mind does is says, I don't like this. I want this to stop. I want it to go away. And you wind up tightening all the muscles around that area. And with the tight muscles, that pain gets more intense. So when you start forgiving, you start letting go of those tight muscles and forgive whatever pain arises in your body, even a headache. And you'll see that it goes away pretty quickly. So this is a way that you can heal yourself more quickly. Hating the sensations if you cut yourself. I only wear sandals, but when I was in Asia, I went barefoot quite a bit. And walking in the forest is not a good thing to do barefoot. And I'd hit a root or a rock or whatever, and I'd wind up breaking one of my toes. And after a period of time of having this happen, I started really seriously watching the process. And what I saw first was when I kicked the toe, there was pain. And my mind went, there's pain. And then I'd see my mind go and start to become angry. And I would use the 6 R's and relax and start sending forgiveness and love into the part of my body that hurt. And quite often, it would break the skin and I'd be bleeding and I'd go back to the cootie and go to sleep. The next morning, I'd wake up and I'd look at my foot and I'd go, what happened? Oh, that's right, I kicked that thing. And I might limp around for a couple of days, only a couple of days, before the forgiveness, I just forget that it's there. It just doesn't hurt anymore. A couple of days. Most people that have broken toes, it's a month. But when I was walking and that pain was there, I was forgiving the pain right then, every step. Why? Because that pain is telling me I want to be loved. So I did that. I gave it to him. So it's pretty amazing the power of forgiveness. And also the power of gratitude. The power of gratitude. They're finding out now that the more you practice gratitude, the brain starts to change and actually starts to grow. And then you have a more positive mindset. And that's great. So be grateful for everything. Be grateful for seeing something that's truly beautiful. These flowers, I mean, these California poppies, I mean, they're wonderful. And I find myself just standing looking at them, being grateful that they're there, wishing we had some in Missouri. I don't know if they'll grow in Missouri. Maybe we can try getting some seeds to see if they would. But every month we have different flowers coming up. And one of my favorite months is June because we have the yellow. I used to call them tiger lilies, but these are yellow, not Easter lilies, but they grow wild. And every time I see them, I smile. It just makes me happy because these guys are beautiful, outstanding. I'm really grateful for them. And I'm grateful for the amount of rain that comes, even though sometimes it might rain 2 or 3 inches at a time and everything floods, and that's okay, no problem. Image having rain here and being grateful in your mind that that is there. Watch what happens. They keep on talking about this is going to be a drought, And everybody seems to agree, yeah, okay, this is going to be a drought. Now we have to take care of the water. Well, why don't you start imaging clouds coming and rain at exactly the right measure that's needed for right now? Keep doing that. Art Bell, years ago, on his radio program, he started telling people to, when there was a big major fire, to start visualizing rain and putting the fire out. And he got amazed, and he was actually told to stop doing that. Because he'd get a lot of people together and they'd start visualizing rain, and then all of a sudden it was there and the fire would go out and it wouldn't be so devastating. Don't pay attention to what the media says. Most of the time it's nonsense. It's no sense in it at all. It's only what they're trying to project you to think about. But you all have your own free will in what you're going to think about and what you're going to image. And, oh, there's 75% of the people that are depressed. Well, if there's 75% of the people, I might as well get depressed too. No, don't need to. Be happy. Help other people to be happy. Please. It makes life so much more fun. It truly does. Okay? Any other questions about what to do after retreat? You all got it? You all understand? Okay.
So you like say we can send the forgiveness or metta to our physical pain?
Yes.
But for the
meditation pain. Use the 6 R's. I've told you this how many times now? I want to control it. I want this pain to go away. Fastest way to keep it. Use the 6 R's. Meditation pain will go away when it's supposed to go away. Okay? Okay, you had a question?
Yeah.
Not many. I think the best psychotherapy is the 6 R's. Okay, I'm not going to go any more into that.
The best one I heard was from Puneji. He said, psychotherapy is to make abnormal people think normally.
The Buddha taught normal people how to be supernormal. That sounds like him. Doesn't it? And he's the old monk that's going to be coming to help me with the translation. I just had 2 short conversations with him. And he changed my perspective of Buddhism. Just 2 conversations with him. Amazing. He's quite a remarkable man. And not very much appreciated in Sri Lanka.
That's amazing. He's an MD and he has a PhD in Western philosophy and a PhD in Western psychology.
Yeah.
And he's a learned monk.
Oh, yeah.
What's his name?
Huh? Puneji.
Puneji.
Venerable Puniji. He's not the abbot of the biggest monastery, the Theravada monastery in Malaysia, but he's like the main speaker, because the abbot is not a very good speaker. I don't know. Okay. And he's been told for the last 3 years that he shouldn't be traveling. And he's been traveling every year. But he is starting to feel the effects of it, and he does need to have more rest and that sort of thing. I tried to encourage him to start eating more turmeric, because his heart is, and it has some problems, and he also has diabetes. And the turmeric will help him with his circulation and help build his heart muscle up. So I told him he had to take at least 2 spoonfuls a day. I don't care whether he puts it on the food or just takes the spoonfuls, but he needs to do that for himself.
Do you have a view on healthy use of alcohol? Like social drinking on the weekend with friends?
Do not.
Is wine better than tequila?
My view on alcohol is it's good to pour on a cut. It's one of the precepts, isn't it? I abstain from taking drugs and alcohol.
And why is, can I ask why?
Because you have a tendency to break the other precepts when you do it, especially speech. And I can pretty much tell when people are pretty heavy into alcohol. If they come and do a meditation, they have a horrific time with sloth and torpor, dullness of mind, and it makes your mind dull.
Tell them about your senior students who just, they kept coming for retreats and they just couldn't keep that precept. What happened? Well, they just sort of,
they faded away.
They just didn't make any progress.
They don't make any progress, right?
They'd get to the point and then...
And the first part of the retreat was really, really hard for them, because they had so many hindrances coming up, especially sloth and torpor. Their mind was just dulled out. And you come for a 10-day retreat, and you only make progress on the 9th or 10th day, there's something wrong with that practice. And what's wrong with it is the alcohol.
I know with my Dharma friends that have been practicing for years that just the practice should become more and more disenchanted with alcohol. It's just kind of naturally drops away.
With patience. A lot of people don't have that kind of patience. Now, there is a time when you can use alcohol as a medicine. Like, my mother was told by the doctor before she died that she should take a little bit of wine before she went to bed. But it's not going to affect her thinking in any way. This was to help keep the circulation going and that sort of thing. But I had one friend that he did some alcohol, and he cursed like a trooper. I mean, he was always using foul language. And he would come for a retreat, and the first 7 days of the retreat was absolutely terrible for him. But the last 3 days he started settling down, and he didn't have so many hindrances, and he actually had a little bit of progress. But he'd been my student for a long, over 30 years, until finally I got him to stop cursing or taking alcohol. And then he started progressing very quickly. So one of the things that was an absolute shock for me when I came back from Asia was I would watch TV and the foul language that they were using on television. And I'd listen to the radio and the foul language they were using on the radio. I was completely shocked by that. People that use foul language, they hurt themselves a lot because it's offensive speech. And generally, every time they were cursing, they had anger. So they hurt themselves a lot. And hopefully you learn enough here that you become intelligent enough that you don't do that. It does make a difference. Yeah.
Can you share, I don't know if you can, but can you share the two insights that Konichi shared with you about Buddhism that changed your perspective? Or is that too long?
Well, what happened was I had just come back from Burma after being there 2 years, and people there wanted me to teach meditation. And at the time, K. Sridhamananda, he's a very famous monk. He's written 60 or 70 books that are very well received throughout the world. He invited me to stay at his monastery because he said he's getting old. He wanted me to give a Dhamma talk every other Friday night. And there was 300 to 500 people that came every Friday night. And Puniji came to visit him. And he told Puniji that I was teaching loving-kindness meditation. And I went down for breakfast one day, and Puniji is there, and he says, "I hear you're teaching meditation. How are you doing it?" So I started telling him. And before long, he stopped me and he said, "You're teaching exactly right, but you're using the language of the Visuddhimagga. Why don't you let the Visuddhimagga go?" Now, that was a revolutionary idea to me at the time. "And just use the sutta language." So I saw that that's a good idea, because always I was comparing the suttas back to the Visuddhimagga and it didn't match very well. I always went back to the Visuddhimagga because that's what I was taught to do. And now he comes along and says, "Put the Visuddhimagga down, use it as a reference if you want, but just start reading more suttas and seeing what happens." And as I started reading the suttas, I didn't have that contradiction of the Visuddhimagga anymore. I started understanding this stuff very well. And I thought, I wonder what happens if I give a retreat and I just read suttas to the people instead of freelance talking. And I started noticing that their progress in the meditation started to get really good, really fast. And then when I figured out that relaxed step where you do it, people, and it, this is something that was absolutely unheard of in Malaysia at the time, because people would practice for years and years to get a jhana. And people that started practicing with me because of the suttas, they started getting into the jhana so fast I had trouble keeping up with them. And those are the conversations that I was having with Poonanji, of just, I'd take a sutta down to him and I'd say, you know, I think I understand this. Is this right? And I'd tell him what I understood and he goes, yeah, good. So that's the influence he had. All he had to do was just point me a little bit, because I was so enthusiastic thinking that there has to be something other than the way that I'm doing it, because it doesn't really work this way. There was massive ideas in Malaysia with the Theravada monks, which means mostly Chinese and Sri Lankan, about the importance of anicca, dukkha, anatta. And because of Mahasi Sayadaw and his influence, he wrote a book called The Progress of Insight. And he wrote about how you attain Nibbana through seeing anicca or dukkha or anatta. And people were experiencing what he said in The Progress of Insight. And I did too. But when I came back disillusioned, because I started seeing my mind does not try to stop me from breaking a hindrance or a precept. So I don't think this is right. And I was looking for something else. I really was. But when he just said, put the Visuddhimagga down, the importance of anicca, dukkha, anatta got its proper place. And it's not the main focus. It's something that you see, but seeing dependent origination is where it's at. And even Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote a book on dependent origination from one of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya. And in his introduction, he said, this is the backbone of the Buddha's teaching. Well, he didn't say that anicca, dukkha, anatta was a backbone. He said dependent origination. So I started exploring that and found out, yeah, that's true. So he was a major influence, because he set me on the path. I've been looking for it for years and years and years, and thinking that I'd found it and then not being satisfied with it and then started looking more. So forever I'll be beholden to him. I really have a lot of respect for him. And you listen to some of his Dhamma talks, they are so good and they're so right on that you just sit back and go, wow, that's really something. That's great fun. And I've kind of copied him in some ways, not purposefully, but there's some wrong ideas out there, and he would start mentioning that and I would start going, yeah, he's right, and I'll see what I can come up with. But some of what I use is his ideas. He's the one that started looking at the Eightfold Path with the word harmony. And I really took to that. Harmonious whatever. Oh, that makes a lot more sense than right or wrong. So, I'm forever beholding to him. Okay, let's share some merit then. May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas, the mighty powers, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.